Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. And hey, it's time to take a look at the wonderful world of insects at our state with our guest, PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I know we'll talk about mosquitoes for sure. There's also the New World screwworm that we wanted to mention. And of course, the upcoming Wisconsin Insect Fest. And looking forward to hearing more about that from PJ. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions. What kind of insects have you noticed on your lawn or in your home? Maybe what's your favorite insect? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. PJ Leash, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure to be here, Larry.
Understand you've been seeing lots of news about a fly called the New World screwworm. This is not a fun insect to have around.
It's not. This insect is one that can actually, it really stands out in this regard. It can attack live flesh. Now, not so much for humans. It could happen in theory, but it's primarily an issue with livestock. Now, one really important thing right off the bat that Wisconsinites should know is this really is not an issue for us here. This New World screwworm is primarily a tropical, subtropical insect. So it needs warm, humid conditions. So places like Texas, potentially, that's where we're seeing a little bit of activity at the moment. Just in the last couple of weeks, there have been some cases confirmed there. Historically, there was some activity in parts of Florida. Otherwise, I think of it in, historically, Southern U.S., Central America, parts of South America. But there's a really interesting history story behind it as well.
And it's, so they're not here, probably not likely. They probably could wind up in, if some cattle wound up here or something?
Yeah, I would say it could happen in theory, but it would basically be a self-limiting situation. You know, if you had cattle or some sort of livestock or animal, a pet dog or something that had these in, transported up here from Texas, had somehow missed an inspection or something like that, it could happen in theory. But again, with the climate temperature conditions, it's not going to be a pest issue for us up here. What I am watching more closely that could impact us in Wisconsin, and I will say I'm not an ag economist, but depending on what this does, if there has to be more money put into inspections, regulations, quarantines, and things like that, that could have some impacts on commodity markets and livestock prices and things like that. There could be some impacts to the market. But again, not going to be an issue for farmers or just general Wisconsinites up here.
Maybe add some money cost to the price of beef.
Yeah.
It's a possibility anyway.
Yeah.
Well, something that does affect us is the mosquito population. And with all the rain in parts of Wisconsin, I got to believe mosquitoes are, they certainly are present in my neighborhood.
Yeah, it's been really variable thus far. Now, when I think back to conditions earlier this year, we started out latter part of winter, March and into spring and April. Things were pretty wet, and then we hit about a month of dry conditions. And I suspect that might have kind of limited some of the mosquito development potentially. And now we're getting into a wetter period the last week or two. And so it wouldn't surprise me if we start seeing even more mosquito activity just in the coming weeks. That could be, potentially just in time for 4th of July. Many areas that I have seen and gotten reports from, folks are saying, it's not too bad right now. There's some. But if you get into some of the spots, maybe wooded areas, the mosquitoes definitely are there. But I'm really curious and waiting to watch and see what happens over the next couple of weeks with the rain we're getting.
Here, I've failed a little bit as an interviewer because you mentioned, I'm going to go back to the screwworms for a minute. You mentioned that the screwworm had an interesting history. And I should have immediately said, well, tell us about what did you mean by that?
It turns out we had eradicated New World screwworm from the U.S. in about the 1960s. And it's due to a particular quirk in the biology of this insect. So many insects that are out there, the females can mate multiple times. They're mixing the gene pool, so to speak, getting variation in there. But there are certain insects, including New World screwworm, that only mate once. And that is the weak link in the chain, so to speak. If that female mates with a dud male, for lack of a better term.
Sterile male,
she will not produce viable offspring. And so entomologists in the early and mid-1900s were talking about this. And then as we got into the post-World War II era, they really figured out how to sterilize these insects. And it was that atomic age, and they figured out they could use a dose of radiation. Now, you have to get the dose just right to sterilize the males, but if you basically zap them too much and it alters their behavior, they're lethargic or they can't fly, it wouldn't work. You need their behavior to be close enough to the wild males out there that these sterile males can mate with the females. Now, basically, USDA scientists figure this out. They start releasing large numbers of these sterile males, which mate with the females. That's her one chance. And because the males were sterile, she doesn't lay viable eggs, the population crashes. And so they tried this on an island in Florida. It worked really well. They tried it on another island in the Caribbean, worked there too. So they've got this proof of concept that's working. And then they went into Texas and it worked there. And so basically this insect had been in Texas. They pushed it down farther to the south. Now, Texas is huge.
Yeah.
But if you look at geographically, Central America, it's a natural funnel. And so over time, they basically pushed it farther and farther down to the Isthmus of Panama, a narrow strip. And so it held them down there. They had multiple facilities raising these sterile males, very successful. But things have changed just in the last decade or so. Things have kind of jumped up above that Darien Gap. And now we're seeing a little bit of activity in the U.S. So people are keeping a really close eye on it. But we did eradicate them here back in the 60s, and we don't know exactly what's in store for them next.
They jumped over. Okay. Oh, man. We have some photos that we'll get to. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, though, has something for us. Vern, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So when I lived in Milwaukee, back in the 50s, in the 60s, we had cockroaches all over the place. I worked at a grocery store. You know how they got transferred? Well, they would recycle the pop because it came in bottles, same with the beer. So they would store the cases in the basement of the grocery store. So they would take the cases to get the bottles clean. That transferred cockroaches to every place there was.
So the cockroaches were going to the leftover pop and or beer.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about cockroaches in Wisconsin, we do have a number of species out there. We have a much simpler situation than places to the south of us that are warmer, where you can have roaches that live outdoors. In the state and really across the U.S., our number one pest is the German cockroach, which is a small one, got two black stripes behind the head. There are bigger ones. Sometimes folks call them palmetto bugs, but the American cockroaches, and those do sometimes show up in larger facilities. I've heard of them in grocery stores on occasion, you know, steam tunnels of big buildings, things like that. Luckily, over time, pest management professionals have gotten some better products. There are some really good baits that can work well to control cockroaches these days. So they're still out there, but again, we don't have the level of issues with those here in Wisconsin at this point in time compared to areas to the south of us.
Jonathan emailed us. He recently lost roughly 25 ash trees, which were the canopy for the forest that he has. The understory, though, is full of young ash trees. Are these doomed to the same fate by the bug?
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic. And when emerald ash borer first got in, that was kind of the doomsday scenario, is that this insect would come in and just completely eradicate and make ash trees extinct in our area. We're not seeing that. What happens is emerald ash borer doesn't attack very young ash trees. They have to get to a certain diameter before EAB really takes a liking in them. And so what we're seeing is that EAB comes in, wipes out all the larger ash trees. There's this massive abundant seed bank.
Sure.
So you get these seedlings. They're not going to be attacked at first. They have to get up to a certain size before they're attacked. And those trees might get big enough to produce their own batch of seeds. So what I suspect will happen over the course of time is that we will see ash remain in the forested and other areas, but we're probably not going to be getting the really big mature trees we had in the past. It's probably going to be smaller trees. In some cases, they may be more shrub-like, but from a biodiversity standpoint, that could be a good thing because there are certain other insects and organisms that can rely on ash for their own survival. So that is a little bit of a good story in that ashes are not going extinct entirely.
We had a photo, an emailed photo from James, a butterfly he found in New Glarus in a parking lot and wonders what kind it is.
Yeah, it's a beautiful moth. This is one of our giant silk moths. And if you haven't bumped into these moths before, we have several species in the state. This one happens to be a Cecropia moth, but we've got Cecropia and Polyphemus, Luna moths, and so on. And they've got wingspans of about 4 to 5 inches. The adults are out this time of the year. And actually, the adults being so big, they would make a good meal for a bat or some other nocturnal creature. So they really don't live that long, maybe a weekish or so. They're basically out there trying to find a mate. Female's going to lay her eggs, and they don't live too much longer after that.
Mm. Back to mosquitoes for just a minute. Why is it that some people are more attracted mosquitoes are attracted to some people more than others. Like, they're really attracted to me, for example.
You're sweet, Larry. That's why they like
yeah.
you. It turns out this has been looked at, and there's a term out there that sometimes is thrown around that folks are mosquito magnets, and there's definitely truth to it. We know mosquitoes seem to like certain individuals more than others. It turns out it's not one single thing. It's a bunch of interacting factors. A lot of it can do with our own bodily physiology. You know, some people run warmer or maybe cooler, so to speak. How much carbon dioxide do we exhale? Also, if you think about the chemicals on our skin, we sweat. That sweat is not just water. It's got all sorts of compounds in it. So we have our unique scent, and that can differ from one person to the next. Also, if you think about our microbiome, the microbes that live on us, bacteria, yeast, they can modify those chemicals and further alter our scent. There's some other factors as well. We know there are some differences between certain blood types can be more attractive than others. If you are pregnant, you tend to be more attractive to mosquitoes, and makes perfect sense. There's
yeah.
so many physiological changes going on
sure.
in cases like that. There are some factors like alcohol consumption. If you are a regular consumer of alcohol, beer, wine, or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
I can see where that would work.
That can have some impacts on physiology. Also, at the time you're drinking it, you're going to be exhaling different chemicals, aldehydes and ketones and stuff like that in your breath, and that can affect your scent as well. So there's a whole bunch of different factors that kind of work together to make someone more or less attractive to mosquitoes.
Sarah in Prairie du Sac has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Larry, just wanted to call in. I heard you guys recently talking about German cockroaches, and kind of wanted to share a little success story. Over the winter, my dad had an infestation of German cockroaches, and we were able to fight them off. There's a website called Guy's Pest Solutions, and he really helped us kind of understand how to get rid of them more permanently through, like, boric acid and Nibor D. And then growth regulator discs, as well as changing out baits. And anyway, I just wanted to plug Guy's Pest Solutions because that guy is really an expert and he really helped us a lot.
All right, Sarah, thanks a lot. Are you familiar with this?
I'm not. I haven't heard of that particular website. I mean, I'm glad, Sarah, that you found some good information. And often when folks see a pest, their first inclination is to run to the hardware store, buy a spray, spray it, and hope it works. But often with some pests like German cockroaches, you really need to look at some of these fine details to fully control the situation. And so I'm glad you found some information out there that was helpful.
So boric acid?
Well, boric acid can be a general stomach poison to insects. Certain sure. baits will contain it. There's a whole bunch of baits out there. And one thing with German roaches, you have to watch the baits closely. If you keep using the same bait again and again, there can be resistance issues. And also the ingredient, active ingredient, might work, but there's something called bait aversion, where for whatever reason, they just kind of change their taste of what they're looking for. And if they stop feeding on the bait because yeah. they don't like the taste, it's going to stop working. So you have to keep a close eye on that and kind of rotate between baits sometimes to make sure it works.
We have Jill sent us a photo. This sphinx moth has seen recently in the UP. It has two rosy spots on the wings, but later they turn brown. Is this stress related?
No, not stress related. And this is one of our members of the sphinx moth group. And that family is pretty diverse. We have some that have relatively small wingspans of maybe an inch, inch and a quarter. And then there are some like the one we're looking at here in the studio that have a very large wingspan. That could be about 4-ish inches or so for some of those species. Each species will have slightly different coloration. And I will say, also, if you see an insect, be it a sphinx moth or other insect, if they have emerged and just molted to the adult stage, their color will be changing a little bit over a matter of the first several hours of adult life, so to speak, as they're going through this kind of hardening and tanning process. So I wonder if that might be a possibility here, because that specimen looks to be in pretty pristine shape. So I wonder if it's pretty newly emerged.
Now, how long would that sphinx moth live?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, a large moth like that, just like the giant silk moths, would make a heck of a meal for yeah. a bat or some other vertebrate creature. So probably not terribly long. I don't think of adult moths like that living for weeks and weeks or months and months. It's generally going to be relatively short. So it might be a week or two, maybe a little bit longer if they got lucky. But again, usually not terribly long lived.
We got Bill in Oregon coming up, but before that, P.J. Leash is our guest. He manages the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for listening in to WPR News. Larry Mueller here at noon. The Wildlife Writers are back, and it's time for another roundtable talk with them. And we'll look at the news from the Natural Resources Board. We'll look at funding for the DNR, maybe the results of the latest turkey hunting season, and of course, a whole lot more. Right now, we're looking at the world of insects with P.J. Leash. Join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. You can also email us to talk@WPR.org, and we've already gotten some nice photos, and certainly if you have an insect photo you want to send for ID purposes, perhaps you can do that. talk@WPR.org will get you there. Bill in Oregon, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind, Bill?
Hi, Larry. Hi, PJ. Thanks for taking my call. We regularly buy dried mealworms to feed birds, and we had a surprise for us. One of the bags that we've been sitting in a bin for a little bit, we pulled it out, and it's full of these little metallic bluish-black beetles that are maybe a quarter inch long and about an eighth of an inch wide. And I was just wondering if you might have any insight over on what kind of things could lay eggs and survive in a bag of dried mealworms.
PJ's nodding. I think he knows.
Yeah. When I heard the mealworms, one insect popped into my head right away, which is called the red-legged ham beetle. And it is the size you described, about a quarter inch or thereabouts. And it does have this metallic-y, kind of a dark blue color to it. It's a rather pretty insect. And I don't bump into these often, but they're very fond of protein-rich materials. Typically, I'd say 90% of the time that I see cases of these, they are in pet food, like dog food that's maybe stored in a garage, or, you know, if you've got a small dog and a big bag of dog food and it sits there a while, those are the typical places I bump into it. But in this case with the mealworms, that's a good protein source. And so it sounds from the description that it would be that species. One thing you could do would be very easy to do if you took that bag of mealworms and just threw it in the freezer for about 2 weeks. That should kill any of the insects that are in there. And then if you're feeding them to birds or whatnot, you know, they're not going to mind if there's another insect in there. They're already eating insects. So that's probably going to be your simplest course of action.
All right, Bill, thank you. So, well, will the birds eat the live ones?
Oh, gosh, they probably would. I'm not aware of them having any particular chemical defenses or anything like that, so okay. they probably would. One potential nuisance issue is if the red-legged ham beetles, you know, escape from that bag and they start to wander, you know, is there a chance they get into something else? So that's why you could either use it up quickly or throw it in the freezer. Even, you know, you can keep it in the freezer and scoop out what you need and use that at the time.
Oh, that would be a good way to do it. Bill, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Charlie in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, I was just calling in thinking of the woman that was asking about the cockroach pest control. We have been having an issue where we fumigated our basement for a flea infestation a couple of years ago now. It was about 2 years. And still to this day, when insects enter the house, they die within about 30 minutes. It used to be very, very extreme where, like, anything that stepped foot in the house would suddenly die. But now it's still happening a few years later. And I was wondering if that was, like, a problem.
Yeah, interesting situation. I mean, often when I hear of folks, you know, kind of what they call fumigating for things like fleas, I wonder in this case if you had used what folks will often just call a bug bomb. It, you know, it's this pressurized canister from the hardware store. You pop the top, it releases fumes. Those are the ingredients in there from the pyrethroid group. They're generally not terribly long-lived, especially in treatments like this. It's a very short-lived type of thing, can work against insects that are out in the open, but won't really work against things hiding in nooks and crannies. And so just given the time, there shouldn't be any more of that around, basically continuing to, you know, kill insects. So that has me scratching my head a little bit. I will say there are plenty of insects and related creatures, other arthropods, that will sneak in to homes accidentally. They are just not adapted for indoor life, too dry for them. And so they get in, and from their point of view, it's a wrong turn. They're desiccating, yeah. They're drying out, they will die. And sometimes they can perish relatively quickly. Now, not on the order of 30 minutes. So that has me scratching my head a little bit. I'm not entirely sure what's going on. But again, if you just see insects like in your basement, a lot of especially older homes will have things that sneak in and just die with the dry conditions. But again, the fumigation, if used one of those pressurized bug bomb type canisters, that should be long gone since it sounded like it was a couple years ago.
Now, if you had a service come in, a professional service, would they use different materials?
Yes. And to be honest, there's very few situations where I would suggest the pressurized bug bombs, or sometimes those are called total release products. Pest control professionals, they are going to use various types of products and formulations that depend on which particular pest they need to manage. There's not a one-size-fits-all, come in and just treat, and it's going to control everything. You really need to figure out what pest is present, where to kind of pay their attention, and that'll inform them which products to use. So they do have options that can have longer residual activity than what you and I can get at the hardware store.
Sure.
But each situation is a little bit different.
Jan in Viroqua, we'll give you a chance to join in now. Hi, Jan.
Good morning. And Larry, thank you for everything. I wish you joy in the future.
Thank you.
I like bees, and I think bumblebees are especially fun. But a friend of mine pointed out a different kind of what looks like a bumblebee, but it has a brown spot on its back. And I've since he pointed them out, seen a couple. Are these disruptors of the native system? Are they a problem, or can I just enjoy a different kind of bee?
I suspect you're just seeing a different kind of bee. Now, when you think about bumblebees in Wisconsin, if you look at some of the papers published out there, we know of close to 20 or 24 different species of bumblebees. Some of those are going to be very, very rare. We obviously have some that can be quite common. But folks often don't realize that there's a very kind of long list of bumblebees that are out there, and they do vary in appearance. Some can have kind of some reddish brownish color on the body. Sometimes that can be very distinct and conspicuous. Sometimes it's just a very subtle reddish patch. Many folks have heard of the endangered rusty patch bumblebee, which in my mind just has kind of a hint of that rusty patch. There's a lot of variation there, but if it was about the size of a bumblebee, probably just one of the other species you haven't seen very often. If the size was different, maybe a bit smaller, probably just one of our other native bees. And we have somewhere between 400 to 500 species of bees in Wisconsin. So there's quite a bit of variation in size, appearance, color, and habits out there too.
For Jan, what would, or anybody else for that matter, what would be a good source to take a look at all the various bees that we have in the state?
Yeah, gosh, there's a number of good resources out there. Some of my colleagues on campus, Dr. Claudio Graton and his group, they have some good identification guides out there, especially for things like Wisconsin bumblebees. Years ago, with some extension colleagues, I wrote a Wisconsin bee identification guide, which if you hop online and Google Wisconsin bee identification guide, you should be able to find that through a UW website. There are some other good resources out there, too. There's a Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade, and there's, I think it's a website called Bumblebee Watch, if I remember correctly, that folks can actually take pictures of bumblebees, submit that as part of a kind of community science project,
sure,
or contribute data, which is really neat. And then there is one app out there which is really neat. It's specific to bees. It's called Bee Machine. And my colleague, Dr. Claudio Graton, and is involved with this a little bit, and some of his colleagues, it uses like computer learning and some of the visual tools to help figure out what bee you might be looking at. So there's a lot of cool resources out there.
Jan, I hope that helps. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Got another photo. Maybe Jeff can get a bigger picture of it for us. This is from Chris in Portage. The other day, Chris spotted this black insect right outside the garage by the door frame. It was large, close to 2 inches long. What kind of insect would this be?
Yeah, so I can tell that this is a large, dark-colored beetle, has some pretty prominent mandibles or mouth parts on it. This is a type of stag beetle, and this is one that I recognize right off the bat. The species is Lucanus placidus, and the larvae of these are associated with rotting wood. That could be a log, a standing dead tree potentially, a stump, even decomposing roots underground. Interesting story about these. When my wife and I first moved into our house, we had in our front yard this low-lying area, a couple feet across. There had to have been some huge old tree there at some point, and it was cut down years before we moved in, but there still would have been the roots below ground decomposing, and there were larvae of these living in there. Now, I didn't ever see the larvae, but every spring right around Memorial Day, the adults would pop out. And one of the very first years that we were in our house, I went out there with a headlamp. I saw one night, kept going out there. And there was one night I went out and I had about 500 of these huge, like inch and a half long beetles in my front lawn. I took a picture just scooping up a handful of these. It was so cool. From an entomologist point of view, I thought it was so cool. My wife probably thought I was a little bit nuts at that point, but they are very, very impressive insects to see.
Mary in Oconto emailed us. She messaged you a while ago about a huge bald-faced hornet's nest in the woods just off her yard. Wanted to know the best way to get rid of it because, you know, bald-faced hornets. You let her know that unless it's a location where people or pets get close, she should just leave it, and she did. She actually saw them in her flower garden alongside the butterflies and bumblebees with no issues whatsoever, even when she was working close by. And she says, please explain this to other listeners. We don't need to get rid of these things because we're afraid or just don't like them.
Yeah. And I mean, one question that I get both on this show, Larry, but just kind of across the board when I engage with the public is they'll ask, you know, what's a Sinsect? Is it good or is it bad? And it makes me chuckle a little bit because I think to myself, we don't walk down the street and think to ourselves, is this person good or bad? You know, it's a continuum. And so we have something like bald-faced hornets that, yes, if you're right up next to the nest and they're riled up and they're stinging you, you're not going to label them as a good thing at that point in time. You're not going to be happy about it. But if you can give them enough space, these insects are social wasps like yellow jackets, bald-faced hornets, and so on. They are A, good predators. They can help control pests that are out there, so they play a role in the ecosystem. B, they can actually be pretty darn good pollinators. If you look at their middle body region, that thorax, it's quite hairy in appearance. And I have seen plenty of these late summer into the fall on things like goldenrod, and they're just completely covered in pollen from that. So they definitely can do some good things. And again, in cases like this, if someone calls me up, I usually ask, what's the context? Where is it? If it's right outside your front door, you probably need to do something about it. If it's in the back corner or out in your woods, and you can just steer clear, these insects have annual colonies. They will naturally die out in the fall, and then you don't have to worry about them after that point.
Rana in Cameron is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Rana.
Hi, Larry. A number of years ago, and I think it was Phil that was on the program, talking about a study that was being done in Florida about a particular type of mosquito, and the study revolved around was similar with that screw worm with treating males that were not productive.
Yeah, sterile males.
sterile males. And so I'm wondering if that study brought about the study with the screw worms or what, how that whole thing came to be.
Sure. Thanks, Rana.
Yeah, so the screw worm research would have been first because, again, some of that dates back to first half of the 1900s. And, again, we eradicated New World screw worm in about 1966 in the U.S. There have been some efforts in the last, 20 or so years where folks have used various techniques, either mosquitoes that are potentially genetically modified or mosquitoes, and this is true of many insects, they will have microbes that live in their bodies that play important roles in their biology. And so maybe you leave the mosquito species how it is, but if you do something to change their microbial community in their body, that might have an effect that could reduce their reproductive capacity. So there have been a number of studies that have looked at this. You know, some have had good success. You do have to consider, though, if you're using something very specific like this, you might be locally impacting one species of mosquito. But if your area has lots, like dozens of different mosquito species, you might not notice an impact in terms of the number that are landing or biting you. And also another thing is, it's one thing to reduce mosquito numbers, but does that translate to reducing the transmission of diseases? So it's an area that it's really cool science. There's lots of ongoing research and more research needed, but it's kind of cool that we could potentially use techniques like that rather than just a broad spectrum, you know, pesticide spraying to be able to manage pests.
As long as we're on mosquitoes, Jim in Boston emailed, is there a preferred blood type mosquitoes like or a type they might avoid?
Yeah, good question. So there is. There has been research looking specifically at that. I will say off the top of my head, I don't remember which specific blood type it is that makes you more attractive to mosquitoes. So I would have to check on that. But I'm sure you could just hop online and look that up fairly easily. But again, there are some known differences between blood types making you more or less attractive to mosquitoes. And that's something we fortunately can't really change in that regard.
Yeah. I'm O positive, so maybe that
that's might, be the one.
Might be the one. Jeff will probably look it up for us and let us know. It's O.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So there we go. And by the way, as long as we're still on mosquitoes, what about, you know, we get a lot of calls, and my own daughter's getting married, and she'll be getting married outside, but there are a lot of times people say, well, we've got this family event or something, and how do we get rid of the mosquitoes for that event?
Yeah. There's really quite a few different ways you could go about doing this, and it would depend a little bit on, like, the size of the event. If it's a relatively small gathering, like a, you know, a family barbecue, one option might be to set up a number of fans just to get some air movement. Yep. With their small body mass, they wouldn't be able to land. If you've got a larger event, you know, a wedding, 100, 200 people, something like that, setting up all those fans, you just won't be able to get enough of them out there. So there are some options like that. I mean, there are repellents, but again, at a wedding, you might not want to have to slather yourself up. There are some things, some devices that are essentially area repellents. One brand that comes to mind is Thermacell. I know Off from SC Johnson, I believe they have some similar things. And basically, these devices use a heat source that might be a little candle. It might be an electric heater element, or use a little butane cartridge or fuel cartridge. Heats up the device, and then there is a pad impregnated with a repellent that can be vaporized. And so the idea is it basically makes a bubble for a certain amount of space, and that will help repel mosquitoes and potentially other insects as well. So those are some options. There are also area treatments, which is basically an ultrafine mist in the air. Those are short-lived. And then there are what we call barrier treatments, where products are applied to vegetation. One concern I have is if you have a given spot, a given yard or setting treated once a month, all summer long, that's going to be harming plenty of other insects, potentially.
Yeah.
Fireflies and stuff like that. You know, if it's a one-time deal, you've got a wedding coming up in a couple days, you know, that can make sense. But I have some serious reservations if you're doing that all summer long.
Yeah, you don't want to do that.
What the impacts could be.
I was remembering a time, this is a long time back, with a service group that I was working with. We were at a festival, and we had a booth, let's say, and I was relegated to staying overnight in the booth, and it had been a bad mosquito year, and I put some mosquito repellent on me fairly liberally, and I woke up in the morning, and there were hundreds of mosquitoes it was almost like there was a barrier. They were like a few inches away from me, but they wouldn't, you know, I didn't get bit.
Yeah. I mean, there are a number of repellents out there. DEET is kind of the old gold standard.
Yeah.
IR3535, picaridin, oil of lemon eucalyptus. And these have the science backing them up. They can work very well. You have to read the label to see how long they last for. But again, if you use them correctly, they can work quite well to help keep the mosquitoes at bay.
Carl in Eagle River has something. Let's go there. Hi, Carl.
I'm looking for a more economical way to eradicate mosquitoes in a larger pond. We have a lot of mosquitoes, and I notice the hardware store sells those pucks to add to the water that kills the larva, but they're really expensive. Is there a place that you can order that those pucks more economically?
I would suspect so. And what you're referring to, these little pucks or briquettes, they contain a specific type of bacterium called Bacillus thuringiensis, and it's a specific strain that works just against fly larvae, including mosquito larvae. So you have to basically guesstimate the size of your pond or body of water, put in the appropriate amount, they break down, the mosquitoes feed on little bits of debris, and it takes care of them. I suspect if you hop online, you know, Amazon these days, there's various companies that sell pest control products, you might be able to shop around and find them cheaper than your local hardware store.
Carl, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. PJ Leash, our guest today, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Tomorrow on the show, join us for another meeting of our Larry Mueller Show book club. We'll talk about the novel Pigeon Falls. Really enjoyed it. The author's Jeff Elzinga. And then we'll talk about some legal issues with lawyer and longtime guest Mike Riley. Now taking a look at the world of insects, back to mosquitoes for a minute. Jeff looked up that type A is the least preferred by mosquitoes, that blood type, whereas O is the most preferred.
And I'll say, Larry, I'm type A, so if you're O, we've got two different ends of the mosquito spectrum in the studio.
So you
want
to walk around with me out in the woods. Oh, my gosh. Let's see. We want to go back to the emerald ash borer, too. Patricia sent us an email, and you mentioned the borers only attack trees of a certain size. Could you elaborate on that? What age or size? She has a lot of ash she had to take down, wondering how long new sprouts will take to grow to a size that the borer will attack. And also, what other critters benefit from the presence of ash trees?
Yeah. So in terms of the size, I'd have to check in the literature for the exact size. And generally, I am thinking of diameters of maybe an inch, inch and a half, to maybe 2 or 3 inches. So we're talking about young trees that are maybe getting 8+ feet tall potentially.
Yeah.
So it would take several years to get to that point.
And the other critters that benefit from the presence of the ash trees?
Yeah, so there's a quite a long list of insects that can live in or on or around ash trees. When I got my foot in the door with entomology back in about 2005, as a summer extension intern, I was surveying hundreds and thousands of ash trees in southeastern Wisconsin looking for emerald ash borer. We hadn't found it yet. And one of the resources I used for training purposes was a USDA booklet just on insects associated with ash trees. There are certain like little beetles that live in the seeds of ash trees. Mm-hmm. There are other borers that can be associated with ash trees, but they don't attack healthy ones. They just go to ash trees that are dead or dying. So when emerald ash borer first came in and we had all these dying trees, I actually saw an increase in some of those local species. Now they've gone back down. There are some cambium miners, weird flies that live under the bark. And again, there's a pretty long list of other insects that can be associated either specifically with ash or they might use ash in addition to some other tree species.
Vicki in Millidor emailed us. She has hundreds of tiny grasshoppers in her lawn, sure to get bigger, she says, and they're in the lawn and garden, and luckily her garden is mostly goldenrod, milkweed, coneflowers, asparagus, and rhubarb. The grasshoppers have turned her rhubarb leaves into green lace, and they are on the milkweed, but not much on the goldenrod. There's something she can do to cut the numbers down. Her cats go out to the fence yard, which contains the garden, so she can't just spray or use powders.
Yeah. Yeah, a couple thoughts. I mean, overall, grasshoppers are very common. We've got dozens of species in the state. In general, they're kind of these generalist feeders. They can nibble on a very wide range of plants. I usually don't think of them as being terribly damaging in Wisconsin. If you go to the western U.S. where you have drier conditions, grasshoppers can be a big agricultural issue out there. We usually get enough rain that there's actually natural diseases and pathogens and things that kick in and kind of keep their populations lower over time. So my suspicion in this case is if you watch over the course of the summer, there's a good chance quite a few of those grasshoppers could die for a variety of reasons. Lots of things like to eat or attack grasshoppers. If you felt you needed to do something to protect those plants, one very easy thing you could do would be to spray them with something like an insecticidal soap or a horticultural oil. Keep in mind, both of those work by direct contact. So you have to spray it onto them for it to work. Once they dry, they're basically done working. But that would be a, you know, pretty soft option that you could do to at least knock their numbers down in the short term.
You mentioned fireflies in passing, I think, once during the show. I didn't want to touch on them. How's our population of fireflies doing? And we have more than one firefly.
Oh, yeah. We have at least 20 or so different species of fireflies out there. To be honest, a lot of them can be pretty hard to tell apart, even under the microscope. There are some that we consider species complexes, meaning As scientists, we don't quite know very well how to tell them apart right now. There might be subtle differences behaviorally, like their flash pattern or flight and things like that. In terms of populations, it's always a little bit hard to tell because so many of the reports are anecdotal. Firefly numbers can also vary quite a bit. If we have dry years, they don't do well. Fireflies as larvae, they feed on things like slugs. And so I tell folks, if you want fireflies, go find some good slug conditions. And so I often see my highest firefly numbers in lowland, like wetland areas, valleys. Where I live in Middleton, go down by the Pheasant Branch Creek, and that's often a great spot that I see lots and lots of them as well. So it's really hard to gauge as a whole how their populations are doing. But worldwide, scientists have expressed concern about firefly populations just due to urbanization, pesticide use, light pollution, and other factors.
Completely forgot about our Wisconsin Insect Fest. And that's taking place Friday, June 24th at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. All kinds of insect-themed things going on for the family.
Yeah, not June, Larry, but July 24th.
I'm sorry, July 24th.
Yeah, so Wisconsin Insect Fest, this is an outreach event UW Entomology has hosted. This is about our fifth or sixth time doing this event. Second year in a row, it's back at Olbrich Gardens. So it's the afternoon of Friday, July 24th. We are kicking things off at about 3 p.m. This year, it's going to be an afternoon into an evening event. And we're also going to transition to nighttime insect surveys with black light traps. So if you want to stay out late and see some cool bugs, that will be an option. It's a family-friendly event. We've got activities for all sorts of ages from 3 to 7. We're going to have a variety of talks, guided walks, workshops, other activities on anything from macro photography of insects to beetles, moths, and caterpillars. In the evening, we're going to have a screening of a film called The Extraordinary Caterpillar, just celebrating the life of caterpillars and importance of them. This happens to be during National Moth Week, so it's very fitting. We'll have a talk on moths as well. And then that'll lead into the nighttime insect surveys. It's going to be a fun event. It's free. It's family friendly. Again, it's at Olbrich Gardens, Friday, July 24th, starting at 3 p.m. And we hope to see you there.
Sounds like a lot of fun. And I understand you have a question for me, PJ.
I do, Larry. So I know you've been doing this an awfully long time. I know most of your shows you host from in the studio here, but I know you've hosted locations like Bayfield County and elsewhere. And so my question for you is, outside of the studio, what's the favorite spotter location you've hosted the show and why?
Boy, I've been all over the state with these. Beaver Creek Reserve up near Eau Claire, Wise Nature Center there. We had a lot of fun. I got to put a tag on a butterfly up there. We did, and that was a lot of fun. The Schlitz Audubon Nature Center, the Weir Nature Center in Franklin. A week at the State Fair was absolutely wonderful. The Green Bay Botanical Garden, the Janesville Rotary Garden, had wonderful times there. Probably, though, I'll go to Bayfield for the setting is wonderful, but also because I started doing that about 28 so years ago, and I've done it, did it every year to bring in Bayfield and Bloom and broadcasting from the center there, the Bayfield Pavilion was always probably the one I'll remember the most often, at least. But thank you for that. And PJ, it's been a lot of fun talking with you over the years. And I'm hoping we'll meet down the road, but Lee Rayburn will do a good job with you, and thanks again for being with us.
Yeah, well, I always appreciate the opportunity to come on the show, Larry. It's been a blast over the last 10, 12 years joining you in studio.
Yeah, it's been fun. PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He's a great guy, and he knows, obviously, a whole lot about insects. And he will be continuing to be on the show as we go down the road. Actually, looking forward to hearing him and just listening in. Maybe I'll call and ask a question. Coming up, our roundtable, our Outdoor Writers Roundtable. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.